From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today we'll talk with the director of NASA's flagship X-ray telescope about its ongoing mission to explore the hottest regions of the universe. And another NASA mission, SOFIA, tackles a different part of the electromagnetic spectrum.
One of the most exciting things we can do with infrared telescopes nowadays is we can see some of the very youngest galaxies in the whole universe.
Then a Milwaukee area organization helps people get access to car loans through financial education.
It is such an awesome, powerful, palpable experience to watch somebody go from, I have no idea where my money is going, and look at it on paper after a week and go, oh my goodness, I can't believe where my money is going. The program is powerful that way.
And we meet two people who've gotten their cars through that program, Ways to Work. Lake Effect comes your way next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect for Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. In 2005, Marquette University established the George Coyne Lecture Series on Astronomy and Astrophysics. Each year since then, the university invites a distinguished speaker to campus to deliver a talk. And every year, Lake Effect has interviewed those speakers, beginning with Father Coyne himself in 2006. Last September, that speaker was Harvey Tannenbaum. Dr. Tannenbaum is the director of NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Boston. He received his degrees from Yale and MIT and has been awarded the NASA Medals for exceptional scientific achievement and also for outstanding leadership. In 2005, he was elected to the National Academy of Science. It's considered to be one of the highest honors awarded to a U.S. scientist. He joined me in the studio in September. Dr. Tannenbaum, welcome to Lake Effect, and thanks so much for joining us.
It's delightful for me to be here.
The Chandra X-ray telescope was actually something that you started. You were somebody who put the initial bug in the ear of NASA. Is that correct?
Yeah, the actual idea goes actually into the early 1960s when the first X-ray sources were discovered, and Riccardo Jucconi, who led the team and actually received the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2002, a year after the first discoveries, talked about a telescope with properties quite similar to Chandra. But it was about 15 years later when he and I together wrote a proposal to NASA saying it's time to really get going on this project. And so in 1976 is when the work which led to what is now Chandra actually got started formally.
So for those of us who don't know what the differences in telescopes are, obviously it's looking at X-rays, but what does an X-ray telescope do and what do you see that you don't see with other telescopes?
Yeah, the astronomical objects, stars, galaxies, almost everything that's out there can put out its energy in various different forms, running all the way from the radio through the infrared, optical, things we see with our eyes. Infrared relates to heat, for example. Then X-rays, things that are very hot, and gamma rays where even more energetic events are going on. And we call that span from the radio to the gamma rays the electromagnetic spectrum. And we've realized over the past few decades, if you want to really understand what's going on in a star or a galaxy, you really need to cover it with all the different kinds of telescopes. It's not enough just to look with your eye. In fact, your eye can't see most of what's coming in, both because of the wavelengths that the eye is tuned to, but also the atmosphere on the Earth. We have to get up into space to do infrared, to do X-rays, to do gamma rays. We can do optical and radio from the ground, but all the other parts of the spectrum, we have to get up into space. And so in the X-ray part of the band where Chandra's tuned is really looking at very hot and energetic events. So we often talk about stellar explosions and collisions, places where what we call cosmic violence is the catchword, and things that are very energetic, they're very hot, they may have very strong forces of gravity, very strong magnetic fields, and those are the kinds of conditions that can produce X-rays in reasonably large amounts. In order to detect the X-rays, we need a very different kind of telescope. And so this is not like going to the doctor's office where there's a machine that produces X-rays, shoots the X-rays through your arm, and then the bones sort of absorb some of the X-rays, and used to be film, and now, of course, it's CCD detectors, right?
Yeah.
See the shadows that the bones create. That's not what we're doing. It's just very similar to what people are used to thinking of when they think of a telescope. So there's a set of mirrors, and they're collecting light, but light in the form of X-rays that are coming from stars and galaxies that are out there in space. So the telescope focuses, it makes a picture, an image, and that comes onto an electronic detector. We have CCD detectors and what are called microchannel plate detectors, but they're ways of converting the X-rays into digital signals that we can then send back down to the ground and figure out what the image looks like by putting it all back together on the ground.
And then, of course, figuring out what it's telling us about the universe.
Sure. So, yeah. I mean, we look at the picture itself. Does it look like a pinpoint? Does it look like it has fuzz around it? How extended might it be? We can measure the energy of the X-rays so we can tell if it's very hot or just on the edge of being hot enough to make X-rays. We can look for signatures in the X-ray spectrum, which is the energy distribution, to tell us how much of the various different heavier elements are present, how much oxygen, how much hydrogen, how much iron, for example. It turns out that stars are factories where a lot of iron gets produced, and we want to know how much iron is produced by different kinds of stellar factories and then eventually how it gets to form into new stars and planets like our own solar system and Earth.
So what is Chandra focusing on? What are the specific missions that are going on right now?
What's beautiful about Chandra is that it's an observatory, which means it can do all sorts of science. It does things that it was originally designed to do, and it's doing all sorts of things that have been discovered since the 70s and 80s and 90s when we were designing it and building it, and even since 2000 when the first science was being done. It's open to scientists all over the world, and people propose once a year, and they send in their best ideas. We get 600 or 700 proposals. We can pick about 175 or 80 of them just based on the limited amount of time that's available. So we are studying stars. We're studying supernova explosions, stars that can no longer hold their act together and blow up. We're studying galaxies that bump into each other and collide. We're studying the hot gas that fills the space in between galaxies that are out there. We're studying black holes in the centers of galaxies where material falls towards the black hole, gets pulled so hard by the gravitational forces of the black hole that it gets accelerated to very high speeds and a lot of energy is released, and most of that energy comes out in the form of X-rays. And then there are things like dark matter and dark energy.
So it sounds like Chandra has a huge amount to do and a huge amount to offer scientists here. How is it holding up? It's been in space for a little while, and it's been working for quite some time.
Right. So it's actually, of course, more than a little while. Chandra was launched in summer of 1999. So we've passed the 14-year milestone. It's interesting. Those of us who were in on the ground floor and helped design it and build it, if you ask us how long is expected to last, depending on who you ask or the day of the week you ask, you'll get a range of answers. I would have always said that it was designed to have a 5-year life in space. And anything that you could run out of, like fuel or power, those systems were designed to have at least double so that they would last at least 10 years. When we went back and actually looked at the details when we were having this discussion, we realized that when we were designing and building in the 80s and 90s, most of the electronic components that were being used in the spacecraft in those days had only been what's called qualified. They've been tested under very hard conditions on the ground, and they were certified that they were going to work at least 3 years. So to keep the costs manageable, we designed it with those kinds of parts which already were available and existed. So technically, the design life was 3 years for all of the components. We fully expected them to work longer than the 3 years. We hoped that everything would work for 5 years, and of course, now we're at three times that. And being so excited about the results and maybe being optimists, we actually do a study every 5 years or so. The team from what was TRW that had built the spacecraft and is now part of Northrop Grumman, they do a study to see what's wearing out, what problems we might be facing. And there are a few challenges, but by and large, things are working close to the way they were designed and how they worked when we first launched. So the most recent study is there's what we call no showstoppers, which means there's nothing which is imminently in danger of failing that would preclude us from going 20 years. And they're actually currently doing a look at 25 to 30 years for us.
Which is quite a substantial amount more than you ever expected.
Absolutely. Yeah. And because of a bunch of conditions, many of which we don't completely control, the next X-ray telescope, which we can imagine eventually succeeding Chandra is certainly not going to launch before the end of the 2020s. And even then, it will take a lot of good fortune and hard work to get there. So the fact that Chandra is the only X-ray telescope that has this kind of what we call angular resolution, the ability to take pictures as sharp as the pictures we take, the fact that it's still 15 years after launch, the request to use it outpace the available time by a factor between 5 and 6 to 1 every single year when we get the proposals in. We're not running out of ideas. We're not running out of discoveries. And it's totally reasonable to expect if it continues to work at something close to the current levels that we would actually use it for something like 30 years.
Well, let's hope.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, we do. We do hope, and we also work very hard. We have a great team that keeps a really close eye on things. If they see anything that needs extra attention, we're very, very careful. It's like handling our baby, and we take very good care of it.
You say that the next possible X-ray telescope might not happen until the 2030s. If you were designing it today, what would you change?
So there will be X-ray telescopes between now and 2030 besides Chandra. Some will be smaller. Some will be very specialized to do one particular area of science. But on the drawing boards and being worked today in the sense of something that could fly in the next few years, there's nothing that has comparable angular resolution. So the ability to take these pictures and have the sensitivity and the ability to distinguish very fine features that Chandra has. So what we will do differently, partly keeping in mind that still higher angular resolution, still even better pictures would be very challenging and very expensive. What we've been focusing on is to build something which will take pictures comparable to those that Chandra can take, but with 30 to 100 times the collecting area, bigger, and ability to see fainter objects, more distant objects, to collect more X-rays and be able to analyze the energy content in much, much greater detail. And we basically are working on ideas of how to make a telescope that weighs no more than Chandra, costs no more, and somehow will deliver between 30 and 100 times more X-rays down to the detectors. So, of course, to do that, we have to make the pieces, which Chandra's made out of glass that's an inch thick, the different parts of the mirror. We're talking about making things that are 0.4 millimeter thick, so about 50 times thinner. So if you imagine that if you make it 50 times thinner, you could get, for the same mass, about 50 times the collecting area. And we're working in the lab, and we're making very good progress at demonstrating the technology to do this kind of work.
Without the shuttles, though, would it be launched on a rocket?
Yeah, it will be launched on a rocket. It could fit on what is already available, either an Atlas V rocket that exists and is launching things. I don't know that it'll be launching things in, say, 2030, but there's a chance. And there's also a bunch of entrants into the commercial development. And there's a Falcon 9 Heavy that has all the capability to launch. In fact, it will cost substantially less to launch Chandra on an unmanned rocket than it did cost on the shuttle. One of the things that's really interesting about Chandra is that it's in this high Earth orbit, which means that every couple of days it goes to a distance that's the equivalent of a third of the way out to the moon. Of course, not always in the direction of the moon, but that's how far out from the Earth it gets, and it comes back down. And it's above the radiation belts of the Earth about 80% of the time, which means we can look at the sky a good fraction of the time. When we're in the radiation belts, there's too much noise in background, and our detectors basically can't see anything. But the other thing is because it's not going around the Earth in low orbit, a satellite that goes around the Earth like the space station, like the shuttle, and even like Hubble, it goes from light to dark 15 times a day. It goes from being in sunlight and it's getting power from the sun and the sun's heating it up, and then it goes into the backside of the Earth and the sun is blocked and it has to run off its batteries. Its temperatures cycle up and down. Everything is mechanically and thermally being stressed 15 times a day. So there's a lot more wear and tear. Chandra doesn't have that. It goes out in this high orbit. When it comes down close to the Earth, occasionally the sun gets shattered for 10 or 15 minutes, but very infrequently, and it doesn't have the same stress. So once you build it and put it in this high orbit, you can't service it. It never gets close enough to the Earth to go up and fix anything. So even if we had the shuttle, and even if we had spare parts, there's no way to really rendezvous and put them in. But because it's in this orbit where there's much less stress on it, once you get there, it really turns out that there's a much better chance that it'll work a much longer time than you'd originally thought.
As it's been proven.
As it's been proven.
Right.
So it's a very cost-effective way, It has a little bit more risk associated at the front end, and everything has to work just as you've designed it. But once you get out there and once everything's working, this possibility of a 10, 15, 20, and maybe even 30-year life is not just a dream. It's actually potentially a reality.
And, of course, it's just bringing back all of that wonderful information that helps us understand our universe.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Tannenbaum, I can't thank you enough for coming in and talking this morning. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. It's always fun for me to have a chance to talk about Chandra.
Dr. Harvey Tannenbaum is the director of NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory. It's located at the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Boston. Dr. Tannenbaum delivered the COIN Lecture in Astronomy and Physics at Marquette University last fall, and we spoke with him then. Well, the Chandra telescope isn't the only one gathering data. Later this spring, our own astronomy contributor, Jean Creighton, will have the chance to add to the body of scientific knowledge. We'll hear about her once-in-a-lifetime trip when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Before the break, Dr. Harvey Tannenbaum, the director of the Chandra X-ray Observatory at Harvard, described how the now 15-year-old telescope in high Earth orbit is still returning a lot of data about the universe. But Chandra isn't the only weapon in NASA's arsenal. SOFIA, or Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy, is another of NASA's data-collecting missions. And very soon, our own astronomy contributor, Jean Creighton, will take a very special journey to take part in it. She joins me now in the studio to explain.
I am going to get to observe from the largest flying astronomical observatory in the world. That is flying in the stratosphere, which is about 45,000 feet. And the advantage of being so high is that means you're above 99% of all the water vapor, pesky water vapor that is happy to breathe, but unhappy if you want to look at infrared light.
Okay, so you're going to be on this trip. How did this happen? Back up a little bit and tell us how you got selected for this, because not everyone gets to do this.
No, of course, no. This is a highly oversubscribed opportunity. It's called a NASA ambassador. And they selected in the end 12 groups. Each group has two people. A lot of the people involved are teachers, but NASA is also interested in inviting people like me who do a lot of public outreach with the planetarium. And they wanted to get us in so that we can bring all that excitement and the science that we learn to everybody.
So you're going to go up one time?
Two times, hopefully. So the whole project, so I will be in California for a week, and the hope is that I get two, you know, weather permitting and all that, that I get two 10-hour shifts at 45,000 feet.
So how do you get up there? I mean, is this, you literally take off? What?
Yeah. So this is an airplane. It's a specially equipped Boeing 747. In fact, this is a special, it's called the 747 SP because it was a special airplane. Boeing tried the idea of having an aircraft that has fewer seats, but that allows it to go longer stretches. It turns out that Boeing, after a while, realized that this isn't what they need. They needed more seats and maybe less range. So this one got repurposed, and now there is a 100-inch telescope put in the side. So there's a hole in the airplane, and of course, you can imagine they've done a lot of testing to make sure that the plane behaves as you would hope a plane behaves. But there is a hole in the hull of the side of the airplane, and that's where the telescope is isolated. And the good thing about that is that at 45,000 feet, the air is very cold, which is good because that means that the telescope isn't bombarded by noise. So the telescope can see what it's wanting to see, and it's not seeing the infrared radiation that a body like me at room temperature, I emit quite a bit of infrared radiation, as do you, Bonnie.
I do.
Yes. But our eyes aren't sensitive to it. So that's why our telescope comes in to help us to see things that our eyes and other kinds of telescopes can't see.
What is the kind of data that you're going to be collecting in this kind of flight that you couldn't get, say, from the Hubble telescope? Are you just looking at a different spectrum?
different telescopes are sensitive to different parts of the spectrum. So the Hubble Space Telescope is used mostly for either visual, where it's important to be in front of, you know, on top of the whole atmosphere, or parts of the ultraviolet where you simply cannot observe it from the ground. Time on the Hubble Space Telescope is much more expensive, so this fulfills also the need of just more data a little cheaper.
Now, are you looking for something in particular, or don't you know that yet? Do you know what kind of data you're collecting?
I won't know specifically until I know when I'm going, because at this point, as you can imagine, the scheduling considerations are significant, and we won't know until a month before we fly. So I should fly sometime between the 1st of April and the last day of May. So I don't know yet what projects we're going to be involved with, but the kinds of projects that SOFIA does involves anywhere from the solar system all the way to galaxies. So because we can see infrared, and dust and gas emits a lot of infrared radiation, we get to see, say, if you wanted to study the rings of Saturn or other rings, that would be a good choice. If you wanted to see how planets form in other solar systems, that's a good choice, because when stars are young, they're still enshrouded with all the gas and dust from which they came. So when stars are really young, you can't see through all that muck unless you have an infrared telescope. Also, one of the most exciting things we can do with infrared telescopes nowadays is we can see some of the very youngest galaxies in the whole universe. So we're still trying to put together how a particular galaxy, how do galaxies get born, and that is one of the things that we want to put together, find out what they look like very early on in their careers and look at different galaxies at different stages of their evolution and put together how they get to look the way they do now.
Well, okay, the science is really cool, but to me, the fun part is you're actually going to get to go and you're going to be that high up in the air. Are there any special things that they've told you you need to prepare, things you have to wear, things you have to be aware of?
Well, first of all, we're going to need a medical clearance and security clearance. We spend a week there, and the first half of the week prepares you for all the kinds of things that you need to know. One thing they've told us a few times, so I guess it must be true, it's very loud. I mean, this is not a, it's not like a commercial airliner where
it's dampened a bit.
Even it's still pretty loud, but obviously you don't have a hole at the side of your airplane. So it's going to be fairly loud. I've seen a couple of pictures, and it looks like it might be cool as well, so people are dressed for cold. I had to laugh because they were telling us, don't give us your special request for food. This is not going to be chicken or pasta. You'll bring your own food.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I thought, okay, well, that helps understand the scope of this. We are going to spend time with astronomers who are on board to get their own data. But apparently some astronomers opt for other people to get their data, that they don't have the time to invest in
to actually
getting
go on
them
the flight.
Themselves,
yeah.
which seems a little strange to me, but I'm happy that they want other people to collect their data. I have a special affinity toward infrared astronomy since I spent some time at Caltech as a postdoctoral researcher. And I was involved in an infrared satellite as the scheduler. I was the coordinator of 12 different science groups, and I was trying to make sure that we schedule their observing time so that we can get as much out of our allotted time as possible from a scientific point of view, and make sure that the individual science goals of each program were met. And that was tricky because there were a lot of even conflicting needs and wants.
I was going to say competing demands.
Yes.
On limited time.
That was tricky. So anyway, it's great to, you know, be part of that again.
Well, and to actually be able to go.
Yes.
Is the plane set up in such a way that you can actually look out the window when you're not working with the data?
I think so.
So
yeah.
You'll actually be able to see the curvature and all of that. Oh, that. You know, the science fiction geek in me is thinking, oh, I would love to do that, to be able to see the curvature of the Earth.
Yeah, I must say that this whole experience has been sweetened by the fact that I'm reading Chris Hadfield's book. He's a Canadian astronaut, and it's a great read. But he's talking about all the preparation that he needs to do. Obviously, an astronaut needs to do a whole lot more. It kind of gets you in that frame of mind that there's going to be this drama of getting into this huge airplane. I'm not a pilot. I've never flown any planes, but I love flying as a passenger. So the idea that I get to go into, you know, a Boeing 747 and be that high in the sky is exciting in and of itself. To have, in addition, the opportunity to get observations in the infrared is a second bonus. But the third one, of course, is that I'm going to have to think about how to best share that story as it unfolds and afterwards with my audiences and with the public.
Absolutely. Well, of course, you're going to bring your camera phone.
Of course.
Yeah, you'll be videoing along with everybody else. And you'll, if you can, send it back to us and we'll put it on the website.
Okay.
That
sounds like a plan.
Cool. Yeah. Since you're going to be going for all of us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very, very cool, Jean. So we'll be talking to you up until the point you go. And then, you know, when you come back, we'll have a debrief. We'll have the official Lake Effect debrief.
I can't wait.
Me either. Thanks so much for telling us about this.
I'm so excited. Thank you, Bonnie, for giving me the opportunity.
Lake Effect contributor Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium, which is located on the campus of UW-Milwaukee. Later this spring, Creighton and her partner Kathy Gustafson, who's a high school science teacher at Nicolet High School, will fly two missions in the stratosphere to help collect data for NASA's Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy Project, otherwise known as SOFIA. There is a link to the SOFIA website from ours, wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Coming up next, we'll learn about a Milwaukee area organization that helps people get access to cars to get to work. We'll learn more when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North and glad to have your company this morning. While a contract to run Milwaukee County Transit has been awarded, the winning bid has been challenged and the county is investigating. But no matter who eventually does run the system, many Milwaukee bus riders still complain the system doesn't meet their needs. But a car also remains out of reach for many residents. The Milwaukee-based organization Ways to Work has been trying to address the issue. It offers financial counseling and access to affordable loans to help people buy their own vehicles. Since July, the Southeast Wisconsin chapter of the YWCA has served as one of the latest providers of the program. We'll hear from two people who went through the Ways to Work program later in the show. Jennifer DeMont-Molin is the chief program officer at the YWCA. She met Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce at their offices on the border of the Brewers Hill and Halyard Park neighborhoods, and she explained why such a program is needed.
One of the concerns that many of the people we serve encounter on a daily basis is transportation. How to get to where they need to get to the next stage in life. And as we know, bus lines are limited at best, and our families often experience circumstances that require them to take multiple buses. I always say to people, you know, it's an interesting experiment to set your keys aside for a week. And in doing so, do all those things you normally do and see how much additional time it takes you if you don't have your own transportation. It's something that many people don't think about, but once you really stop and you explore that idea in your head a bit, you go, wow, I am blessed to have a vehicle. I am lucky to have a car. Car makes my life easier, and that's true for our families.
So tell us about how the program actually works. I mean, what are the criteria for candidates for the program, and how do you administer it here?
This program is about more than cars. This program truly is about financial competency and confidence. And so in accessing the program, a person would first attend a financial education session. And in financial education, our program manager and often bank representatives who volunteer for the program go through a variety of different areas, including credit, including being banked. You know, what does it mean to have a checking and savings account? Including learning the things about balancing, you know, checking and savings accounts. And we also take time and talk about predatory lending, which is a huge problem in our community and one that Ways to Work works actively to address. So once people attend that financial education, then they determine, is this a program for me? And if it is a program for them and they want to apply, they then take that application, fill out those application materials, and then follow that up with a one-on-one budgeting session with our program manager, where their individual circumstances carefully looked at and considered, and we talk about how are you spending your money and ask people to track how they're spending their money and come back and meet with us and talk about that. It is such an awesome, powerful, palpable experience to watch somebody go from, I have no idea where my money is going, and look at it on paper after a week and go, oh my goodness, I can't believe where my money is going. The program is powerful that way. And so once that process then happens, then we move forward to moving into the actual loan process. We have an interesting situation with Ways to Work in that the YWCA Southeast Wisconsin, nor Ways to Work itself, we do not make the decisions on the loans. Those decisions are made by a volunteer loan committee, and that loan committee is staffed by bank volunteers, volunteers from insurance agencies, volunteers from nonprofits, volunteers from a variety of sectors who are charged with reviewing candidates not for their creditworthiness, but for what they've demonstrated in their character in terms of trying to address some of those credit issues that make them eligible for the program. We present loans and we provide information, you know, about the candidates. The candidate themselves writes a letter to the loan committee about why they need this loan. So it's a moving experience also for those people who are volunteering in that capacity.
What are some of the reasons why the candidates say they need the loans for their vehicles?
Well, in many cases, you know, our candidates, one of the requirements for this program is that you have to be employed minimally 3 months and have a steady work situation. And many of our candidates are in situations where they have the job, but the lack of reliable transportation is preventing them from moving forward in the job or from being the most reliable and dependable employee that people want to be. And so we have situations where, you know, schedules are limited for them. You know, maybe you can make extra money working a different shift, but you can't get to the employer on those off hours, you know. Sometimes people's work hours are such that they wind up waiting around for a bus for 45 minutes every day waiting to access that next bus. And you think about that time over the course of a week and where that time could be spent with children working on homework or, you know, even getting things done like laundry. You know, this is a program that provides people with access to better live their lives. And that's powerful.
So once the loan committee approves the loan, what happens next? How do you guide the candidates to use that money toward a responsible purchase?
Yes. The car is not actually identified until after the loan committee approves the individual for the loan and then starts that process of finding the vehicle. We have a couple of rules. There are a few vehicles that we say no to based on consumer reports. We educate, you know, our borrowers about why we make those decisions. But we also have rules about 100,000 miles on the car or less. You know, we have no requirement of any dealership that they work with, but we have had good experiences with some dealerships who have been very responsive, have even offered, you know, ongoing oil changes to some of our borrowers. And so we look for those good relationships and we say, you know, we've had good experience with them. You may want to check them out and help guide people toward car dealers who offer warranties rather than, you know, maybe the corner lot who wants to get that car off, you know, the lot as quickly as possible and doesn't want to hear from the person again. You know, we are looking to develop our relationships with dealers so that we can better support our borrowers.
You said before that this program is really about so much more than just a car. How does successfully going through this program, being in the process of paying off this loan, affect the candidates?
One of the great things about this program is that this doesn't end when the loan is received or when the car is driven off the lot. This is a case management program. This is a program that somebody gets the car and begins their repayment process. And all throughout that repayment process, which typically is 24 to 36 months, they are in constant contact with our program manager. When something comes up, they're calling and saying, hey, something came up this month, you know, we are creating an environment where the rapport is there, that people aren't afraid to say, oh, something's come up, help me, can you help me figure out how to manage this? That relationship piece is so key because it allows us throughout the process of repayment to help people continue to build their financial literacy. And plus, successful repayment of this loan is actually reported to the credit bureaus. We report. So we are an opportunity for our borrowers to actually increase their credit rating through successful repayment of our loan.
What kind of impact does that have in the long term for the participants in this program, especially for those who are coming in who maybe just don't have the credit history or have made some mistakes in the past or had some unfortunate situations where their credit has taken a beating? What does this do for them?
You know, credit can be challenging and confusing. You know, you get your credit report, you look at it, you go, what does this even mean? By taking out that confusion, by sitting down and step-by-step reviewing that, we're giving people the opportunity to take charge of their financial life. You know, and many times we see in people with credit challenges and that, there's a pattern of spending there that doesn't support them getting ahead financially. One of the things that we see is once people understand how their credit works, how savings works, when we talk about interest and the benefit of interest in that, people become as excited about saving as they do about spending. And that's one of the neat things about this program. It's giving people the information that they need to say, I'm not afraid of this anymore. Oh, I can do this. I had no idea I could do this. I can do this. And you know what? It's not going to stop with this car. It's going to start with this car. I'm going to pay this off. And you know what? I hear there are home ownership programs. You know, it's about saying, wow, all these things I thought were out of my reach, maybe they're not.
What is the rate of successful completion of repaying the loans?
Well, we're a new provider, obviously. But if we look at ways to work system-wide across the country, it's about a 90-some percent repayment rate. I believe defaults are under 10%. So when you look at that as it compares with traditional lending, it's a very, very high success rate. You know, people want to be successful. People want to work. They want to support their families. They want to do the things that all of us want. People want to get ahead. And I think sometimes when we think about people with challenged credit, we forget that their goals and their goals for themselves and their family are what any of us want for our families. And we're so happy to be part of facilitating that movement toward, oh, wow, I can do this.
How does the Ways to Work program fit in with the broader YWCA mission?
You know, the YWCA operates programming around economic empowerment, workforce development, and racial justice. And, you know, when we look at our program areas, this program is vitally important. This program's about access. And really, all of our programming is about access, giving people a chance to connect to mainstream, to connect to opportunity, to get themselves and their families ahead. And it gives us a unique opportunity to do that. A car is a powerful, powerful tool.
How many participants have you had apply to the program?
We've had over 160 people complete that financial education piece. And from that, you know, about half of that amount has taken the application for the loan and has determined that they want to move forward. To date, right now, we've got 5 loans approved, but we've got many, many more in the pipeline. You know, this isn't an immediate kind of program where you come in one day and by the end of the week you have the loan. All that budgeting work, all that front end piece needs to happen in advance of that. Our program manager, Shelby, invests a lot of time in each individual so that we know that when their loan is approved, they feel confident in their ability to repay it. That's vitally important to us. We want to get people into loans that they feel good about.
How is the program funded?
You know, this program is sort of funded in two ways. When the Ways to Work National Office, which coincidentally is headquartered here in Milwaukee, they secure the loan capital for the program. And so that is through their relationships that the loan capital is secured. As an organization, the YWCA Southeast Wisconsin is responsible for raising the funds for program operations. And that includes, you know, the staff time and all the expenses that go into operating the program. Ways to Work is a community development financial institution, a CDFI, and is certified by the U.S. Treasury. And so that means that banks and insurance companies who are looking for Community Reinvestment Act credits as they look to further their own businesses, their involvement in Ways to Work, both financially supporting program operations as well as volunteering and working with our borrowers in financial education or in helping them access financial products, allows those banks and insurance companies access to those Community Reinvestment Act credits. It is a very, very unique program in that way and allows us to give our borrowers access to more services. So that's very exciting for us.
The thing that strikes me about this program is it is so much about relationships and about really getting to know the person. And that seems rare when you're dealing with anything to do with loans and financial institutions these days.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is relationship lending. It is. This is, for us, every person that gets a loan, you know, we know that we will minimally have, you know, a 2 to 3 year relationship. But I suspect that some of these relationships will be very long term. We have a lot of programs to offer at the YWCA Southeast Wisconsin to move families forward. Ways to Work is one of them, but we also help to connect people to all the other things that we're doing. So yes, we are very hopeful for long-term relationships with our borrowers.
As you continue to roll this program out here in the Milwaukee area, what impact do you see right now, and what do you hope to see in the future?
I hope to see a community that is less plagued by access issues. I hope to see a community that is more just through this program, that gives people an opportunity to do what they dream of doing without the limitation of something as simple as an affordable car loan. You know, one of the things I don't think many people in the mainstream financial community realize is that for folks with challenged credit or non-existent credit, interest rates in the 20, 30, even 40% range are very, very common. And so when you look at the cost of a loan in that regard, the repayment of the loan itself in that becomes, you know, a heavy, heavy burden that doesn't allow, you know, that movement forward. Ways to Work is a loan. It does have an 8% interest rate associated with it. This is not a grant. It is not an interest-free loan. It is a loan with an interest rate. So it is a way, too, that people are participating in a mainstream financial product.
Well, Jennifer DeMont-Millen, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having us. We're excited to share.
Jennifer DeMont-Millen is the Chief Program Officer at YWCA Southeast Wisconsin. She spoke with Stephanie Lecce about the YWCA's efforts as a Ways to Work provider in Milwaukee County. Coming up next, we'll hear from two Wisconsinites who have gotten their cars through the Ways to Work program. We'll meet them when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Before the break, we heard about the Ways to Work program, which helps people clear financial hurdles to get car loans, which in turn gets them a vehicle that gets them to their jobs. Tori Johnson is from Milwaukee, and Miranda Vogelman is from Oak Creek, and both went through the Ways to Work program. Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce met with them at the YWCA Southeast Wisconsin offices in Milwaukee, and they explained how they connected up with the program there. Tori begins.
Well, I heard about Ways to Work because I work in the community, and actually I'd recommend like 6 or 7 other people to Ways to Work. And then I decided when my car kept breaking down, my car, and I said, well, I need to go to Ways to Work.
Miranda, what about you?
My daughter's grandmother actually went through Ways to Work and recommended me to go.
Well, give me a sense of where you were at when you realized you might need the services of Ways to Work and what this loan for your car would be able to do to help you.
Well, with me, it was like I wanted the car that was reliable, that's going to start up every day and go. And I also knew that my credit wasn't all as great as everybody else's, so that I knew that here at YWCA that you get another chance. So they're going to look at it and they're going to go over it, but then they might give you that chance to say, okay, we're going to work with you and you could get your car and, you know, work out your credit at the same time.
Traditional lending options weren't available to you.
The ones that probably were, no, they wasn't. And the ones that were was, you know, I wasn't going to be able to afford that no way. So it was going to get me caught up in the trap again.
The trap, what do you mean by that?
The trap was like I called one car place. They said, you've been approved for $20,000. I do not need no $20,000 loan. If I would have bought a car from them, if they would have gave me $16,000, I probably would have been owing like $30,000 back.
Miranda, what about you?
I'm a young parent. I have a 2-year-old daughter. I work and I go to college. I didn't have a car, relied on my mom's. And after a while, it was hard getting her to daycare and me getting to school. And when her grandma told me about Ways to Work, it was an awesome opportunity. Me also being young, I don't have much credit and not that great a credit. So they gave me the second chance to build my credit and to start my future.
Well, tell me about some of the criteria that you had to meet in order to participate in this program.
You have to have a child or a dependent. You have to have been working for 6 months with the same job.
You had to be willing to pay the loan back. right. So I'm on the same thing. With you got to have a dependent child. You have to have at least 6 months at your employment, and you got to be willing to pay it back, pay the loan back.
You both used the same phrase, a second chance. What do you mean when you say that? How does this program give you a second chance?
Well, I don't know. I might say mine would be the first chance, because it's like that was the first time I ever walked on the car lot and bought a car. It was the first time that I'm going to be paying a car note. So it's like, but it's a second chance in having something and working for it and honestly doing it, you know. So it's like, oh, the second chance would be me now is that I pay my We Energy bill when I wouldn't pay it last time. So it's a second chance to actually be responsible and do it the right way.
It's the second chance to have something that you've worked for, and they also work with you on the payments on your income. They break it down to what you make and how much you should save. They organize everything. It's an awesome program.
Did you feel like you were kind of getting a financial economic education as you were going through this program?
Yeah, they broke it down to what I made a month, how much I was spending a month, and what I was spending my money on. And at the end, I realized I was spending more money than what I actually had, and I should start saving so that in the future I can buy the house, I can make this great life of myself. It was amazing.
And with me, it was eye-opening, because I was like, wow, I'm eating too much Kentucky Fried Chicken. And you know, so when Shelby broke it down to me, I did see that I can leave that alone, put more food in the refrigerator. Because she said, I can't believe you ain't spending that much money on groceries. I believe it, but I will be now, because I need that other money to go for my car. But it was like, it showed me also that I could step back and pay off the other people that I owe and still have money.
So this was about more than just the car and more than just that loan.
Yeah, it's more than the car, because now once I do the car, I'm going for the house. And for me to go to the house, I got to go back to that piece of paper that she gave me to say who I owe and how I owe it and how can I go about adjusting my lifestyle was like more important than the car. And that's what I took away from it. The car is beautiful, but it's just that I know now that I see it, because at first I never seen it in my face. You know, people be calling me and I be ducking, but you know what I'm saying? But it, when you see it in your face, she showed me that you could actually do it. And that was the first time that I sat there and seen that I could actually do it on paper.
Why is having this car so important for you to be able to take the next step forward in your life?
Well, for me being young, the car makes it easier for me to work a full-time job, for me to still go to school full-time and to graduate college. Also, it helps me. It's something reliable and safe for me and my daughter. I don't have to worry about my car breaking down at every red light, or I don't have to worry about how my daughter is getting here or how we're getting there, because now we have that reliable transport, and I feel safe getting her to school and getting me to school and to work and home.
And that's pretty much like the same, except I'm not that young. But and being at my age, it is feel good to go outside. And, you know, when I first got in the car, I pumped the gas. The man was like, oh, you ain't got to pump the gas, because, you know, my old cars, you pump the gas. So it was, and then it's like a thing that make you feel good. So when you pull up in the car lot, you go to work, everybody be waving at you, you know, a different way. People walk around you, even your kids say, I'm proud of you, Dad, you know what I'm saying, because they never thought you'd ever do it, you know what I'm saying. So that's what make me feel good, and then it's uplifting. So, you know, it is something to know that I'm going to go outside and start the car, so that just make you feel good when you drive down the street. You know, they say tint the window. I want people to see me.
One of the things I have to ask: do you feel like you would have learned these budgeting tactics or how to build your credit without this program? I mean, are those resources available elsewhere in the community?
I think the only other resource that I did go to that was similar, is just that Shelby brought it up a little higher, was the first-time home buyers program. But other than that, I don't think they just got a budget program like this out here that I ain't heard of it yet.
I've never ran into any other place that cared more about your budgeting and how you're going to do this. And someone that didn't push this loan on me, they made sure that I could pay it off, that it would work in what I was making. It wasn't them trying to sell anything. They worked with me and made sure that I was the right person for it.
Going forward, with what you've learned from this program, with the credit you've been able to build or in the process of building, what do you hope to do next?
Well, my main goal is to pay off the car. And then the next one is to buy a home.
Me also. I want to pay off the car. I want to graduate college.
What do you feel like when you're driving around in your car today, going to work, going to school, taking your family around?
Well, I feel proud. I tell people how I got the car, because it's a simple fact that I put in a process and I got approved. You know, and the lifestyle I used to live and where I come from, you know, I'm the site manager of this place right here, and I'll try to teach other younger people to go the straight route instead of going all the way around the way I had to go through it. So it's like, hey, guess what? Because, hey, you got a beautiful car. Guess I got it. You know, I applied for it. I applied for a loan. I actually got it. You know what I'm saying? When if I was been living the way I was living in the past, you wouldn't have gave me nothing.
I'm really proud of myself. I know that I worked hard for that car, that I am working hard still for this car. And it's something that I did on my own. I didn't ask my mom for help. Ways to Work helped me, but I didn't have to rely on my mom or someone else to help me. And I recommend the company to a lot of my friends. It's amazing. It's a great feeling inside.
Well, Miranda and Tori, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tori Johnson of Milwaukee and Miranda Vogelman of Oak Creek both obtained their cars thanks to car loans they received through the Ways to Work program. They spoke with Stephanie Lecce at the YWCA Southeast Wisconsin offices in Milwaukee, where the program is administered. And that's all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. Be sure to be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect. It's all on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.